Oops, what's happening? Here we go. Professional podcasting featuring Linoleum Knife, the podcast.
A podcast of the cinema, some might say.
Some.
Yes.
Who says that, actually, other than us?
Really just us.
Other than us. Us equals Dave White. I'm Dave White.
Yes, and I'm Alonzo Duraldo.
I'm a film critic for The Wrap, and I've been a film critic for other places, but that was in the past.
Yes.
That was then.
But this is now.
And you are Alonzo Duraldo. You are the co-host of not just this podcast, but Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network, Breakfast All Day on the Breakfast All Day Network of YouTube, and occasionally you plop yourself into Deck the Hallmark to muscle the other three dudes out of the way, steal their spotlight.
Yeah, that's my plan.
Furthermore, you're married to me?
Yes.
And that is your greatest qualification?
Sure.
For being on this podcast.
Also, speaking of Deck the Hallmark, we have a new book out.
You do.
I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies.
I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies is the name of this book. He co-wrote it with the men of Deck the Hallmark, Brand, Panda, Dan.
It's and a swell holiday gift.
It's in all the bookstores. We were just in the Barnes & Noble.
Yep.
At the Grove the other day. And we, you know, at first we were just looking for it on the big tables in the front.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's prime position.
Real estate,
right?
Sure.
And you're looking for that. And then we looked specifically on the Christmas table. It was not on the Christmas table.
No.
Just mildly infuriating, as it is a brand new release from a major publishing house.
Yes.
And
well, if you had not told the bookstore lady who we were, I would have taken like two or three of the four copies and just, you know, subtly taken them downstairs
right,
and put them
on
the Christmas
table. Here's
what
would have happened. We've gone around about this. Here's what would have happened if you had done that. First of all, in my defense, and I don't even need to defend myself, but in my defense, she asked me. She said, "Oh, you shopping?" I said, "No, he's the co-author."
Yeah. You can lie to retail people. You do it all the time. Are you planning to buy something in our expensive boutique? Oh, yes.
No, here's what happens if you're in an expensive boutique in Los Angeles and they ask you if they can help you. What they're really asking you is get out. When you look like me and you're dressed like me, what they're really asking is, would you please leave? And then I say to them,
am I going to have to call security?
Yes. Take me to your most exclusive items, because that's what I'm here for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your fanciest lady candles.
That's right. That's generally what I'm looking for. And so I didn't lie to her. I don't know why. You know why? I'll tell you why.
Why?
Proud of my husband.
Oh, well, thanks.
Being a co-author of a big deal book.
Anyway, they do have it at the Barnes & Noble at the Grove. You just have to go up to the film and TV section.
And ask for where it is.
Yeah.
Because it's not even, they don't even have it face out on the shelf. It's spine out.
Yeah.
Which is, come on.
It's alphabetical by author, so it's under Brandon Gray, who's listed first.
And it's right next to Lauren Graham's book.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just a few slots down from Mark Harris's Mike Nichols book, which
right.
I liked very much. So it's an honor just to be nominated.
It's fixing to be gift buying time.
Mm-hmm.
Go buy that book. Damn it.
Please. You'll be glad you did.
Barbara, please.
Barbara, please. Now, if you have anybody in your life who is into Hallmark movies or who perhaps likes to dunk on Hallmark movies.
Yeah. Do you have anyone who hates them? Because I despise them in so many, not just so many ways, in every possible way. And this book, I've been reading it, and I'm not biased here simply because my lover participated. I like calling you my lover.
Oh God, I hate that.
In front of people because it's funny. It's just a funny word. It's funny to say that you're my lover.
I think the main reason I fought for marriage rights was not so much so that, you know, you and I could be legally wed and have all those right. protections. Yeah. It was just so that I could call you my husband and not ever have to say my lover.
I'll tell you, those gays in the 1970s, they happily walked around saying my lover.
Yeah, I know, but no thank you.
They were proud to be lovers.
They also had a lot of ferns, and that's too much work.
It really is. No, it's a funny book. It is. That's where I was going with this whole question line of discussion. It's a funny book. I like it. It makes me laugh. Also, you dedicated it to me.
Yeah.
And Bibbs.
And Bibbs.
Your other husband.
Only my Hallmark husband.
No, Brand Panda and Dan are your Hallmark husbands.
Yeah, this is true.
Honestly.
Yeah.
If we're going to make straight guys your husbands, then it's those three, really.
Yeah.
The thing is that today we have five movies to talk about.
We do.
I've seen four of them.
I've seen all five?
You've seen all five.
Zoinks.
And you're going to talk about the worst of them, and you're going to do it right now in the space of about 2.5 minutes.
Sure.
Don't go deep on the plot.
Oh, I won't.
We don't have a long time today. We have a whole bunch of letters at the end of this show.
Yes.
Get through. So let's go quick. Let's be like Siskel and Ebert used to be on sneak previews. Ooh. Back in the day when you and I were children and we would watch that show, and they would be done with talking about movie. In about 5 minutes.
If you had cut this introduction in half, I'd be done by now.
That's fine.
Stop setting me up. Red Notice. Oh boy. This is a globetrotting caper comedy with Dwayne Johnson and Gal Gadot and Ryan Reynolds. And at first I thought, oh, this is funny. They're kind of self-parodying here. Like they're going so obvious and so broad that, you know, they're kind of goofing on the very idea of this kind of movie. Oh no. No, they're just doing it, and they're doing it badly. Mm-hmm. It's not funny, particularly. It's not all that exciting. It gets very tiresome, and it's very satisfied with itself. It's directed and written by Rawson Marshall Thurber, which is always a mouthful, who did two previous movies with Dwayne Johnson that I like quite a bit. The very silly but very exciting Skyscraper.
Yes.
And the fairly silly but funny and smart Central Intelligence.
Yeah. Enjoyed both.
Yeah. So this is apparently the most expensive Netflix movie ever made.
Yeah.
La-di-da. It's not great. In fact, it is aggressively a letdown.
I walked through the living room going back and forth doing housework while you watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I picked up. Ryan Reynolds is being encouraged, I think, or else he's just comfortable like this now, being Deadpool wherever he goes.
Kinda, yeah.
And I understand that he has that in him,
mm-hmm.
that quippy, and also satisfied with himself tone that he uses to deliver those quips.
Yes.
You know, the cocked eyebrow, I don't really mean this.
Standing on the outside to observe the thing I'm in. Yeah.
I don't mind that from him. He's good enough at it that he became Deadpool.
Yes.
In the Deadpool movies.
Which is the perfect role for him, but he doesn't have to do it all the time.
I would prefer if we didn't make him lean into that constantly, because he can do other stuff as an actor, and I'm worried that this is going to wear out its welcome a lot more quickly than the people who are making movies with him understand.
Yeah. Like, he needs to do another Buried or something where he can remind us that he does other stuff.
Yeah.
Because even Free Guy, where he's playing sort of a naif, it's still
same deal.
The same deal.
Same deal. So I didn't see this film in its entirety. I just stood in front of the TV and looked at it and then looked at you and then said, No, not this.
Also, no. And not that The Rock and Gal Gadot fare much better, and they have a big fight scene that you would think between the two of them would be something memorable, and it's just edited all to hell, which means they had no rehearsal time, and so they didn't do anything very interesting. Skip it.
Hey, guess what?
What?
We're going way back.
Oh?
Yeah.
How far?
Shang-Chi, that's how far.
Yes, because...
It dropped on Disney Plus.
Yes, on Disney Plus Day.
And now we're here to talk about it.
We are.
And when I say dropped, I mean plopped.
Plopped, yes.
Why don't you talk about the plot of Shang-Chi?
Okay, sure. So this is... Shang-Chi is part of the Marvel Comics universe, and... The movies have not really dealt with him at all, and they certainly haven't dealt with anything that is this sort of martial art adjacent. There are martial arts happening here, but there's also a lot of pointing rays and, you know, CG effecty things going on here as well. Simu Liu plays a guy named Sean, and he and his best buddy...
He's new to me. What else has he done?
He was on Kim's Convenience, which we've never watched.
I've not seen that show.
Which people love, and yeah. We've not watched it. So he plays a guy named Sean. He and his best friend Katie live in San Francisco. They
played
are slackers,
by Awkwafina.
Played by Awkwafina. They're slackers. They're Valley Parkers. And then one day, these goons show up on the bus and attack him, and he fights them off with great skill, and Katie's like, what is up? Who are you? What's even happening here?
He's been keeping a secret from Katie.
Turns out that his parents are both these, like, incredible martial arts masters. His father, played by the great Tony Leung, masters the Ten Rings and has been alive for thousands of years, and those Ten Rings have given him the power to sort of, like, topple governments and you know, defeat any people who got in his way. And his mother is was the guardian of this secret hidden village that you have to go through a moving forest to even get into.
Mm-hmm.
And she passed away. Dad trains him to be, you know, like the baddest man on earth. Fighting wise, and then he runs away and starts a new life. But now these people are coming after him, and they're also now going to go after his sister, which Katie also didn't know he had one of those. So off they go to Macau to try and save her, but she's good. She's actually running an underground fight club ring.
Yeah.
And eventually the two of them get called into service by Tony Leung, who claims that the village is keeping their mother prisoner, but actually it's a soul-sucking monster from another dimension who is fooling him with her voice.
Yes.
And he's going to open the gate that's going to let the soul-sucking monsters out, and it's up to Shang-Chi and friends and the village to defeat it and save the world. So this is directed by Destin Daniel Cretton, making his first MCU movie. He's the guy that made Short Term 12 and Just Mercy and The Glass Cage. Glass Cage? The Glass something. It was The Glass Castle, sorry. And, this is a Marvel movie that doesn't seem too overly concerned with tying itself into the rest of the MCU. The only other person the people that we get from other movies are Wong, played by Benedict Wong from Doctor Strange. And if the name Ten Rings made you think about the fake Mandarin that Ben Kingsley plays in Iron Man 3, well, he shows up too.
Yeah.
It has the space to sort of be an origin story without dragging in Thanos or whatever, you know, the Avengers or any of that.
There is a reference to Thanos, a character a supporting character mentions.
Yeah, we live in a world where half the population can disappear. And if you look closely, did you see the wheat pasted poster for like support, the SNAP support group or something?
I did not see that.
For people dealing with SNAP anxiety or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, there's some world building there. But generally speaking, this is in and of itself. And it's a lot of fun. You know, I had a really good time with that. I think the fight choreography is pretty good.
Yep.
It doesn't, you know, rely on like a lot of editing to sort of like, you know, cover up its lack of preparation. It is funny enough, but doesn't overdo it, even with Awkwafina and the cast. I think they find a good balance for that. Ben Kingsley, quite hilarious in this.
Mm-hmm.
Simu Liu, real charming and like has the movie star thing. Like you want to see him on camera. And Tony Leung, of course, one of the great stars of all time, Michelle Yeoh pops up as Tony Leung's sister-in-law. And she, of course, another legend. So it's cool that you get these legends of Hong Kong cinema and of, you know, contemporary martial arts cinema for that matter. You know, their stuff in the 80s and 90s is breathtaking.
Yeah.
I think that Marvel probably realized after the whole Tilda Swinton and Doctor Strange thing, they needed to up their game. So I'm glad that they are, you know, making a decision that is both right for the characters, but also I think in the long run, I'm sure this movie probably did better in China and other Asian markets because they could say, hey, Tony Leung and Michelle Yeoh are in this movie.
Right. As you know, as I say, every time a Marvel film comes out, I care and I don't care. And what I mean by that is while I'm watching the films of the MCU,
right,
I'm usually having a very good time. And then when those films are over, I forget that they exist. I don't dwell on them. I don't think about them after the fact. Spider-Man, this is the thing I repeat every time, I like to visit with Spider-Man, and then I like to leave him. Having said that, some films from the MCU are more entertaining than others.
Sure.
Some of them feel like work. Particularly, as you said earlier, when they are painstakingly building worlds and making connections and drawing in, you know, other elements from other films that you're supposed to either have already seen or that you need to go back and rewatch or watch for the first time so that you can understand what's even going on. This one has a very light touch when it comes to that. And so it stands by itself. Even though, as we mentioned, there are references to the snap and there are references, obviously Benedict Wong, as you said, shows up and he's going to bring them into, you know, some other place in the next film. And then over the credits, you see who else wants to bring them into the world of the Avengers and, you know, their tangential superhero pals. And what I like about that is there's a freshness to the reactions of Simu Liu and Awkwafina as they come to understand, wait a second, we're superheroes now? And we don't have a choice. Like, we got sucked into this adventure, but now you're here to tell us that
there's more.
There's more, and we have to. Like, and so, you know.
Although I like the fact that the mid-credits thing, they managed to find the joke in that as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So the casting of this with Simu Liu and Awkwafina is really wonderful because, as you said, not only is he a ready-made movie star, but she brings her lovely comic timing and, you know, whatever man kind of attitude that...
It's an audience surrogate.
Pretty much, yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed this. The fight sequences are wonderful. The bus fight is crazy.
Yeah.
The skyscraper fight is crazy. Mm. And all I really need is one good fight sequence in a movie. And this one gave me two plus some giant monsters at the end. Very happy to have seen this. I'm disappointed that, you know, it came out when it did to theaters, when the Delta variant was not at all
abated
under any kind of control. So we weren't in the theater to see this film. But, you know, it works on Disney Plus too. So, yeah, this for me goes into the side of the Marvel universe of... this goes onto the side of, yeah, this one's more what I want.
Sure.
As a very, very casual
viewer
of these films.
You know, we want to see Eternals. Maybe we'll see it in the theater. Maybe we'll watch it on Disney Plus. Who knows?
Eventually it will come to Disney Plus.
At some point, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I do really want to see Eternals simply because I know that it is difficult for any filmmaker to leave their mark on a Marvel film.
Yeah.
And that I my assumption is that they simply don't let you. And apparently they let Chloe Zhao do that. And it's making people angry. And I'm curious about how that has come to pass.
I have heard such mixed responses.
And
not from the people I would have expected to,
right.
Like people I thought would be more into it or not, and vice versa. And I'm like, Okay, clearly I have to see this movie. But yeah, we're, you know, maybe when it's in its, you know, seventh week in theaters and playing to much smaller houses and not the number one movie. What else?
What else is No Time to Die?
Yes.
The new James Bond movie.
We also watched at home.
And it is so very plot heavy, but let me try to give you the bare bones of what happens. All right. The pre-Billie Eilish sequence gives you two flashbacks, both of which involve baby Lea Seydoux and grown Lea Seydoux and her relationship with James Bond.
And with
the villain.
Yeah.
All right. I don't want to tell you too much stuff.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's not like there are big spoilers here, but
there's one.
These films are mechanical in a way that knowing stuff in advance maybe diminishes the pleasure just a little bit.
Fair enough.
Okay. Then Billie Eilish sings the song, and then we come to James Bond, who has moved on from being 007. He is living on an island, and Jeffrey Wright comes back and says, hey, we need you to help find this Russian scientist. He's been kidnapped, and he's got the... He's got the super weapon, the mega weapon that we invented to protect us. But who could have known it would into the wrong hands?
My death ray is being used for death.
They need the assistance of James Bond. There is a new 007. Named Nomi, played by an actress named Lashana Lynch. She participates in this as well. And they run around the world looking for the villain. Can we say who the villain is? Or is that the spoiler?
That's not a spoiler.
Okay, well, it's Rami Malek.
Yeah.
And you know he's a villain because he has scars all over his face.
Oh, movies.
That he isn't also listening to opera is a show of restraint on the part of the filmmaking.
And likes cupcakes.
Yeah. And then they chase the thing around and try to get the thing out of the hands of the bad people, and it takes 3 hours to make all of this happen.
You're obviously skipping a lot.
Yeah, I am, because I don't need to give anybody the whole plot, because there's like an enormous amount of plot.
Right. It is the last of the Daniel Craig Bond movies.
Yes.
And it acts like that the whole time.
Yeah.
It has an air of like, I'm too old for this. I thought I was done with all this, you know, kind of thing going on.
I'm ready to stop not smiling. Said Daniel Craig.
Yeah, you know, it's exciting, and I'm sure on the big screen it's especially like, you know, there's all the Bond stuff that you expect there to be.
Yes.
But, you know, look, within that, there are good Bonds and there are not so good Bonds.
Sure.
I'd say this is a really good one in terms of making the character stuff mean something. And in terms of definitely taking some big swings at surprise moments along the way that I didn't expect. There's this wonderful chunk in the middle of the movie where Ana de Armas shows up.
Yes.
As a newly minted agent who helps him out in Cuba.
Yeah.
And she's a delight.
She really is.
And the whole sequence is really fun, and it definitely
Beautiful gown.
they're playing.
And that's not meant to be an insult. It's really a great gown.
It is, They have some fun with the requisite Bond moments during that sequence that they don't really necessarily goof on as much in the rest of the film. That works really well, and that's where one of the big swings happens. We're like, oh, you know, this story is not what I expected it to be, and it's a whole other thing. The thing about these franchise movies is that they're not designed to end.
Right.
You know, and so it's like Avengers Endgame. You're like, wow, what a big, and all these things happen. But you know in the back of your mind, and then the next one comes out in, 7 months, right? So it's like, you know that there is another Bond movie in the pipeline. There will be endless speculation about who will be the next Bond.
Right.
But there will be a next Bond, and there will be an next Bond adventure. And so that limits what and where and how this movie can be.
You and I were babies during the Sean Connery era.
And you were. I think I mostly missed it even as a baby.
You were born and he was still making Bond movies.
I suppose.
All right. So you were in your little diapers, but you were alive. I, 3 years older than you, did not see a James Bond movie until the early 70s, and by that point, it was Roger Moore. But, you know, on TV, you wind up seeing the rest.
Sure.
On the ABC Saturday Night Movie.
Sunday Night Movie, for sure.
Here's the thing. The character never goes away.
Yeah.
You know. Different actors play the character. The character never goes away. But until Daniel Craig, correct me if I'm wrong, but these were discrete adventures with a beginning and an end. And while the actor might have popped up again in another movie, stuff from the past didn't necessarily follow him.
Yeah, that's pretty true. I mean, there's that moment at the beginning of On Her Majesty's Secret Service where he sort of opens a drawer and pulls out things from previous adventures, which was just a way of the movie saying, no, this is still James Bond.
Right.
And every so often, like, he would visit the grave of, you know, Diana Riggs' character from On Her Majesty's Secret Service in subsequent movies. But you're right. For the most part, they were all designed to be these kind of standalone adventures. This is the first, the Craig movies are sort of the first time they were like, well, what if it's an arc?
Yeah.
You know, and
what if his story continues and you're supposed to follow along?
Exactly.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But by doing that, it makes me wonder where they can go next.
Right.
You know, this ending may or may not matter. We won't tell you what the ending is, but this ending may or may not matter in terms of who comes along and plays the character next.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might decide that this next actor playing the character is going to just continue the storyline. Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah.
But what has happened with me as a viewer is, you know, I've spent my whole life watching James Bond movies.
Yeah.
And I know what is expected of the character. I know how the filmmaking is going to be in terms of, like, you know, particularly now, you know, in the 60s and 70s, it was very much, honestly, it was camp. You know, not quite as much with Connery, but definitely with Roger Moore.
Yeah.
The Roger Moore movies were so intentionally funny, super horny.
Yeah,
even more perhaps so than the Connery films. But you don't get that anymore from this James Bond. You know, and so. It's harder for me as a viewer now to treat this like Spider-Man.
Mm.
You know, to say, well, I've had a good time with Spider-Man, a.k.a. James Bond, and now you can go away and I don't have to remember anything anymore.
Yeah, this movie does expect that you've seen, you know, Casino Royale, Skyfall, Inspector, and then you remember the character interaction, which is like, in a James Bond movie? Really?
Right. And they did their best to make that happen, and Daniel Craig has played a very consistent version of this character throughout. He is the most humorless of all the Bonds.
Timothy Dalton was pretty.
You think?
Yeah.
There is this stoic and grave. You know, distress, I feel, are two different things.
Craig is at least a little quippy occasionally.
Sometimes.
He's not like Roger Moore about it, but, you know, he'll still whip out
Keeping Her Majesty's End up, sir.
Exactly. Craig will still unpack a pun. Timothy Dalton was just like all business all the time.
Okay, well. In any case, I wonder how much emotion I'm expected to have. I had it for Judi Dench in these films, but not so much anyone else. And I understand what I'm watching on screen. I see that I'm expected to feel, you know, concern, empathy, sorrow for, you know, this man's increasingly broken life.
Right.
But I kind of don't, because for me, they have always been, again, giant mechanical machine adventures that I get to be spat out at the end of, like it was, you know, a dark ride, and then I'm done.
Yeah, no, for sure, because I think in previous Bond movies, there's like the woman he sleeps with who then dies, and then the woman who he sleeps with who doesn't die, who he's with at the end of the movie, but who is never heard from again in the rest of the series.
Right.
We never see Pussy Galore again. We never see, you know, Holly Goodhead again. We never see whatever these women whoever Barbara Bach played in Spy Who Loved Me, Xenia on a top, whoever these characters are over the course of these movies. You know, he gets married in Majesty's Secret Service and she dies. And that's like the outlier of like Bond falls in love. It was supposed to be forever. And then, you know, the bad guys kill her.
Yeah.
And so with the Craig movies, it's like the death of Vesper Lynn, the Ava Green character, and the ongoing relationship with the Lea Seydoux character is supposed to be a thing, but that's such a rewiring of what how Bond movies ever worked before that I think, yeah, for people our age who got very used to the old school way of doing it, it's a lot to take in that we're supposed to actually, oh, these women actually, he's going to talk about them again or think about them, and the same one is going to show up in, from movie to movie. Like, that's, this is James Bond. What's even happening
here? Yeah. So, I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I wasted my time. But I also know that, you know, it would be kind of fun if the next James Bond movie was a period film.
You know,
set
in the Cold War.
Set it in the Cold War. Set it in 1972. You know, make it super violent. Make it crazy, horny, whatever you want to do. Go do something different, even if it means retreating into the past to revive, you know, the stuff that is now, you know, not part of the Bond world anymore.
I would love that, but here's why it will never
gadgets,
happen.
Gadgets, gadgets, gadgets.
Sure, yeah. Here's why they will never do that.
Right.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. flopped.
Yeah, you're right.
Which I loved, but, right. You know, and so, yeah, as much as it would be fun to see Bond in Savile Row suits again and, you know, driving the Aston Martin and keeping it very analog, they won't do it.
No, yeah.
We should mention that Cary Fukunaga directed this film, and even at almost 3 hours, it's at a really good clip.
It holds your attention from start to finish. You're not bored by this at all. It's just, there's just a lot of it.
Yes.
There's a whole lot of it.
There is.
You know what else there is a whole lot of, Alonzo?
What's that?
Furniture at rogerandchris.com.
Segway King strikes again.
Okay, so I cleared all the laundry off of our beautiful chair.
Our beautiful RogerandChris.com chair, yes.
Basil English roll arm reading chair. And I'm blanking now on who asked this.
Was it Dr. Steve?
No.
No, it was somebody else.
Forgive me for not remembering who asked for this, but on Twitter, someone wants a photograph of the chair. And that's going to require some styling.
Of course.
Because I need to plump the pillows. I need to
Sun needs to be coming in the window just the right way.
The side table needs to be dusted. You know,
it deserves its glamour shots.
Yeah, the paint patches of potential colors to paint the bedroom wall that are sitting right above the chair. They need to be lovingly attended to. But we will take that photo.
Okay.
In the meantime, go buy your own dang chair at rogerandchris.com. You can select from a whole bunch of different styles, fabrics, legs,
arms,
heights, depths. Well, I mean, the arm No, you don't get to choose your own arms. You get to pick a style with a specific type of arm.
Do you want the roll arm? Do you want the, you know?
Right. But you don't get to, pick a one kind of chair and then pick the arms from another kind of chair.
Obviously, Dave.
Make it clear.
What kind of Philistine do you think I am?
Don't promise something.
You want to see pictures of chairs, go to rogerandchris.com. And while you're there, purchase one.
Yeah. Supply chain be danged.
Yes. And they're made in the USA.
They'll make them in the amount of time it takes to make them, and they will send it right to you.
Yes.
This is real furniture. This is not, the kind you have to assemble yourself on any level.
This is not flimsy
fly-by-night stuff. This is stuff that lasts you for the rest of your days if you take care of it properly. And it is sturdy. If you don't believe me, there was once a photograph of Chris himself standing on one of the couches.
Wow.
And Chris is a giant.
Yes.
Chris is a very tall man who is as muscularly broad as he is tall, I think sometimes. And, this is not Timothy Chalamet. I've been goofing on Timothy Chalamet so much lately. I need to stop.
Stop twink shaming him.
I should not. Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry, Timmy. Chris is a big dude, and he's standing on a chair in one of these photos, and I can't remember where that photo was. It might even be on Twitter or Instagram somewhere on their Instagram account. But, go good chairs, good people running the company, and they'll do you right.
Yep.
RogerandChris.com.
RogerandChris.com.
Let's talk about Passing.
Yes.
This is the feature debut from Rebecca Hall.
Yes.
Who has adapted the novel by Nella Larsen. Nella Larsen was part of the Harlem Renaissance, and she wrote a book based sort of on her own experience as a biracial woman. It stars Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga as old friends who have become estranged and separated from each other for about a dozen years. One lives in Chicago, one lives in New York, but when visiting New York, Ruth Negga's character, named Claire, runs into Tessa Thompson's character, named Irene. And Claire has changed so much that Irene does not recognize her at first, even though they grew up together. Both of them are biracial, but what has taken place in their lives is that Claire has married a white man. This takes place in the 1920s. And the title refers to the historical practice among black and biracial people of what's called passing, meaning you pass for white. And if you chose to do so, you would either use that in a sporadic sense when it was convenient, when it was maybe necessary. This is what Irene says at the beginning of the film, that she has done it for convenience sake from time to time, but not as a way of life.
Right.
Claire has chosen to marry a white man and not tell him that she is mixed race, and he believes her so much that he has an offensive racial slur nickname for her.
Yes, Claire hasn't just married a white man. She's married a monstrously racist white man.
Yeah. And she is experiencing distress about this. She is unhappy in this marriage. She is unhappy with what she has chosen to do. And when she runs into Irene, she really, really, really wants to rekindle the friendship because she misses the community of black people.
Irene has married a black doctor, played by Andre Holland,
yeah,
is very involved in the Negro League, which was an organization at the time.
Yes.
If it was a precursor to the NAACP or if the NAACP already existed, but it's similarly...
I believe the NAACP already existed because the NAACP, if I'm not incorrect, is the group that published the magazine The Crisis, which you do see Tessa Thompson reading at one point.
Anyway, so she is very involved in sort of, you know, black issues and politics and social events. And so for Claire, this is like a way, as you say, to sort of reconnect with the community and sort of, you know, breathe easily and feel like she can be herself without having to, like, you know, worry about being found out.
However, Claire is also just sort of constitutionally a person who will do whatever it takes to get whatever she wants. She says this in the course of the film. She says, "I feel like there's something wrong with me. I don't have feelings. I will hurt anyone I need to. I will take anything I need to get what it is that I want." This does not sit well with Irene, who believes that Claire might have
designs
on her husband, on Irene's husband, who has been giving Claire some attention.
Yes.
Much like in the novel, this ends tragically. And
enigmatically.
Much like in the novel, it ends tragically and mysteriously.
Yeah.
Because we don't know the mechanics exactly of
the tragedy.
I hit the 10-second rewind button on Netflix about 3 times so I could see all the cuts that took place in that sequence to find out what happened and who did it. I won't spoil that, but it's something.
I think Rebecca Hall wants you to live in the mystery.
She does, as did Ella Larson.
Exactly.
I think this is a great movie.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's filmed in
Academy ratio
and beautiful, like high contrast black and white.
Yes.
Which is in and of itself a symbol, you know. Early in the film, we see, you know, Irene, who is more dark-complected than Ruth is, but she herself is entering a hotel, sitting in a tea room, and no one is, you know, but she's wearing gloves. She has a hat with a very low brim that goes over her eyes.
And she's always got her head sort of tilted downward, like, don't look at my face.
Yeah. And there's this great moment before she crosses paths with Claire for the first time where she is constantly clocking the rest of the room and just looking over and like, is anybody noticing me? Is anyone paying attention to me? Am I going to be found out?
Right.
And it is.
She just wants to get out of the heat.
Exactly.
She just wants to go into a hotel and have a cup of tea. And it's a segregated hotel, so she can't, but she does.
Yes.
And that's where she sees Claire.
Exactly. But it is such a POV camera, like, you know, it's almost like you're in Lady in the Lake for a second. Like, the camera is going back and forth around the room just as Irene is sort of establishing who's there and what they might or might not be thinking about her specifically.
I didn't know something before I watched this. I had to go look it up after. This novel was important to Rebecca Hall, who adapted the book for the film, because in her own family.
Yes, I didn't know this either.
Her grandfather was black, and he passed as white. He actively did this in his life. And so in her own family, this experience, you know, sort of informed, you know, her understanding of this subject, which I think is fascinating.
And, you know, when we talk about directorial debuts from actors, you know, there's always sort of a given that, yes, of course, the performances are going to be great. But she's so assured with what she's doing and how she's doing it.
She clearly knows what she wants. This is a film that is very, very still.
Yes, very quiet.
You will not be told much, really. You will be shown. there are glances and physical gestures and, you know, looks that people give each other and, you know, small comments about this or that detail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get. So if you're waiting to be told every little thing, then you're not going to be happy watching this.
This is a movie without for your consideration clips.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It absolutely is without those things.
Yeah.
There's no Oscar speech.
Yeah.
There's no direct grab for your, you know, emotions.
Or that someone's going to stop and explain what this movie is really about.
Right. There are so many moments where the subtlety of what's happening can pass you by. So be prepared to engage with this film directly.
Yeah, if you're watching it on Netflix, which is where it's streaming.
If you're watching it on Netflix, turn off your phone.
Yes.
You need to do that. But yeah, I like a quiet, contained movie.
Mm.
This is super that. It's great.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
It is in a very, very limited theatrical release at the moment as well. I think it's on like 2 screens in Los Angeles right now.
Yeah, it ran
one of the landmark.
It ran a week in theaters, and now it's on Netflix. So it's in even fewer theaters now than it probably was.
Yeah. You know,
2 seconds ago.
Yeah.
It is shot by Edward Grau, who did A Single Man.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, people contained in small environments. Yeah. And then, finally, we can make through. We can make this fast. Home Sweet Home Alone.
Ah, yes.
The reboot, I guess, is what we're going to call this.
It's a reboot, but
it's also in the world
in the universe of Home Alone.
Because won't tell you who pops up, but someone pops up from the original film.
Yes, there is connective tissue.
Playing themselves.
Playing the same character, yes.
Playing the same character that they played in the original film. This stars the kid from
Jojo Rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit. Not the main kid, not Jojo Rabbit, but the other kid. I'm blanking.
Yates.
Archie Yates. Sorry, I didn't have his name in front of me. And he is very much like Kevin McAllister in the original film. He is a thoroughly obnoxious, horrible child that you hate. And he is also a spoiled brat on top of it. So when his family is running off to Tokyo for Christmas with all of their in-laws and cousins and everybody, he is accidentally left at home. Furthermore, the family of the kid, they're also horrible. So you are sort of like, what if you all just went away and never came back? Meanwhile, across town, there's a struggling, working, middle-class family, not working because the father has lost his job. He's a tech guy who is out of work, played by Rob Delaney. The wife is played by Ellie Kemper, and they have to sell their house. And they are having an open house, and in comes Archie Yates and his mom. They don't want to buy a house. They just are looking for an open bathroom so the kid can pee. And while he's there, he stops and he asks what this weird pile of box full of old dolls is, as they are, for some reason, this box of old dolls is out of the closet on the floor. And one of the dolls is very unusual. Turns out to be an incredibly valuable, rare doll. And then that doll goes missing. Rob Delaney thinks that this terrible, obnoxious brat has stolen the doll that could
save his house,
get them enough money to save their house, and so they wouldn't have to sell it until he finds work. So they go to the terrible McMansion where the kid lives. And they decide they're going to do some breaking and entering to get that doll back from this kid who stole the doll. Meanwhile, the kid thinks, oh, these are child traffickers.
Yes.
They've come to kidnap me and sell me to an old lady because of the, you know,
farcical
misheard conversations. So you've got people who think that the kid stole their extremely valuable doll. That's going to save their home from foreclosure versus a kid who thinks he's about to be kidnapped and sold to an elderly woman and locked in a room forever. Which one of these things is true? We don't know. And then, you know, slapstick violence.
Home Alone ensues.
Yeah, slapstick violence comes to pass.
I think that the people who hate this movie, and there are people who hate this movie.
Okay.
Are the ones who grew up with at least the first two Home Alones, if not all five of them.
Mm-hmm.
And identified with Kevin.
Okay.
And like, he's the hero, and they like, you know, the bad guys are the bad guys.
Yes.
Because, and they don't like the fact that in this one, the kid is awful and that the people trying to break in the house are actually sympathetic.
Yes.
So given the fact that you and I have no baggage with Home Alone, we were in our 20s when the first one came out.
Yeah.
I never saw the first one.
No, I know.
Until I was researching Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. Yeah. I just enjoyed this as a Three Stooges-ish, like Rob Delaney and Ellie Kemper fall off of things and hurt themselves. And I had a very good time watching that.
It is interesting to me that if you did grow up with the original film, and you were a kid when it came out, and you identified with Kevin, you were identifying with a terrible, obnoxious child.
Yeah.
And maybe you didn't realize that. I don't know. Maybe you did. Maybe you thought, oh, me too. I'm a terrible, obnoxious child. Is this version of that character even worse? Yes. He's much snottier than the Kevin McAllister character.
Yeah.
But it's roughly the same. And the only reason you wind up rooting for Kevin in the original film is because the criminals are genuine bad guys,
right,
who are seeking to destroy anything in their path and take anything they can get. And they don't care if they hurt this kid in the process.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Kevin, in the first film, still has to come to his own Scrooge-like ending where he learns to be good.
Well, and then
some level.
And he realizes how much he needs his family.
Yeah.
You know, he dreams of being alone without them. And then when he gets it, and, you know, it's the I Wish I Were Never Born from It's a Wonderful Life.
Right.
This kid doesn't seem all that upset that his family left for Tokyo.
No, he's not. He doesn't super miss them at all.
Yeah, he's definitely enjoying, you know, and you get that sort of kid wish fulfillment where, like, you know, they do a Scarface moment where he plunges
his face
into a mountain of jelly beans or whatever. But yeah, you know, you don't. I guess the idea in Home Alone is it's okay that he is a little sadist because the thieves are bad people with bad intent.
Right.
And here you're watching him be a sadist to good people with reasonable intent and who all this is happening because of misunderstanding.
Yeah. He doesn't know what they're really there for. They don't know what he's thinking.
Yeah.
So whatever you've decided is happening, the film is telling you two different stories.
Yeah.
So it's not the movie's fault if you're not paying attention to that.
Right.
This is a silly, inconsequential thing. Rob Delaney is funny. Ellie Kemper is funny. It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't bother me at all. Its existence does not bother me. Its existence also doesn't mean much to me. It is, in the end, if you follow it all the way through to the end, guess what? There's a happy ending, guys.
Christmas.
Because it's Home Alone. How about some letters?
Sure, let's.
We have a whole bunch of them. Let's make them fast.
Okay.
All right. I'm popping them out here. Grant, the movie and TV guy. I'm new to the podcast, but I'm a longtime viewer of Alonzo on What the Flick.
Ooh.
And Breakfast All Day. I always look forward to a new episode for your opinions. I have a question for both of you. Is there a comedy that you think critics and audiences got wrong?
I mean, there are a lot of them that are popular that I think are garbage, you know. Not that critics necessarily liked them. You know, I am the one weirdo who laughed at movie 43. It's
you
not
are.
A movie I can defend in
you
any
are.
Way except that I did laugh. Comedy is real subjective. I mean, everything's
yeah.
real subjective, but comedy
yeah.
especially, I think. So, you know, it doesn't, I don't take it to heart or let it bother me if people laugh at something I don't or vice versa.
What I have found in my adult life is that I am more likely to laugh at stuff that is, okay, Freddy got fingered. All right. How many times have I seen Freddy Got Fingered? 3 or 4 at this point. And that shouldn't be, right? The world says it's bad.
It has a cult and you are part of it.
It has a cult and I'm part of it. But why am I part of it? It is an insane film and made people angry when it was released. Why do I laugh so much? I, too, by the way, laughed quite a bit at movie 43. So what's wrong with me?
Yes. We're broken inside.
I don't know. Films that people think are uproariously funny, they leave me cold.
Yeah.
So, again, getting back to your original sentence, it's all subjective. I don't think anyone's wrong.
Joe, no, of course
you know?
Not. I'll just never understand anybody who thinks that Grown Ups 2 is hilarious.
Right, yeah. If you see Grown Ups 2 and you say that was one of the funniest films I've seen, then we're probably not going to understand each other very well.
Yeah.
You know? Amber Petty says, hello. This is not an ad for AmberPetty.com,
no.
By the way. She says, I thought I'd get a notification when the Ralph Lauren holiday candle arrived, but I didn't. And they didn't offer a note option, hence the mystery. Anyway, I wanted to thank you both for letting me advertise in your show.
Oh, please, it was our pleasure.
And for Alonso speaking to my class. Hope this candle will bring some added Yuletide happiness. Thank you very much.
It already is.
It's not even Thanksgiving. We've got that Ralph Lauren holiday candle lit up.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Amber.
Dr. Steve says, after 11 years of... I'm sorry. He begins his email with, Dear Hollywood Egos.
No.
After 11 years of podcasting, you say you're better at podcasting than any 11-year-old podcaster. Have you not heard the talented Mr. Nick Lemire? He's killing it on Breakfast All Day's Marvel Mondays. So just hold your horses, Mr. Big Shots.
Well, you raise a good point, Dr. Steve, except that Nick Lemire is now 12 years old.
Yeah.
So our original statement holds.
Still stands. Yeah. Holly would like to say, this has nothing to do with anything. I always get a response from kp.org email system within a couple of days. I find it works well. Well, good for you and for Alonzo.
Maybe you should try it.
She says, I want to second Alonzo on this.
Yeah, thank you.
Y'all can just go email kp.org all day and get responses from them because it doesn't happen for me. Christopher. I would 100% move to a higher Patreon subscription level if the reward was a November 1 Time for Fun with Team Satisfaction t-shirt. Thank you, Christopher. Mm. Daniel says, Labyrinth of Cinema sounds really interesting. It's also on Mubi.
Ah.
Use a free trial or a subscription in the U.S. if you aren't in New York or Los Angeles or aren't yet comfortable going to theaters. It looks like the only readily available Nobuhiko Obayashi film in the U.S. right now is this and Haosu.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although I believe the distributor of Labyrinth of Cinema is planning a Blu-ray box of his final trilogy, of which Labyrinth of Cinema was the third film.
I see. Okay. Glenn says, I'm sure you'll discuss this when you see it if you haven't already, but Spencer is a Christmas movie.
It is.
Add that to the reprint of your book.
We'll see if that ever happens.
Hannah says, in early of March 2020, I went to see Autumn de Wilde's Emma with my partner Sam, and we enjoyed it so much that I used my credit card reward points to order us a gift certificate to the cinema. It arrived 2 weeks later.
Oh, dear.
Yesterday, we went back to the theater to see Dune. It was a good experience from both a safety and a film-going perspective. I have some observations from watching Denis Villeneuve's film in Quebec, where he is from, and I would like to share them.
Mm.
Quebec, despite being located in, or as they call it on Letterkenny, Quebec, despite being located in chill, progressive Canada, parenthetically, has a regressive law on the books that bars people who wear visible religious symbols from holding public positions or, if they already work in the public sector, from applying for promotions or new positions.
Yeesh.
Really? This weighs particularly heavily on Muslim women wearing hijabs and Jewish men who wear kippot. In this context, then, I found it interesting to see how many of the characters in Dune wear veils and other head coverings. Denis Villeneuve, the hometown boy who made it big abroad, is kind of a darling here in Quebec. He's probably not thinking about the bill, but as an observer in Quebec, I noticed the tension between our local hero's blockbuster movie and our local laws. The achievement of the costume design is undercut by the score. Hans Zimmer wants the audience to be tense the entire time, which is just not possible for 3 hours. This movie was too long. He also does the thing I hate most about sci-fi scores. He uses non-Western forms of music to signify evil, sinister characters. Ooh. It was also intrusively, distractingly loud as it blanketed lines of dialogue and left me holding my ears shut for big chunks of the running time. That flew right past me.
Well, we had the titles on because we watched that on HBO Max.
No. The
exotic,
the non-Western forms to signify evil. Also, for me, the highlights of the movie were Jason Momoa and Sharon Duncan Brewster, who brought so much humanity and sincerity to an otherwise chilly movie. Thank you for all that you do.
Thank you. Yeah, I was not expecting Jason Momoa to be the most empathetic person in the movie.
Yeah. All the best, Hannah, in Montreal. Did I already say that?
No.
Did I already?
Now you have.
Okay. a question. Brendan says, I watched Repo, the genetic opera, found myself of two minds. On the one hand, I loved it. It's weird, wild, demented, stupid, madcap. It is a singular... Rocky Horror and John Waters and Peter Jackson and Troma and Anthony Stewart Head film. But I recognized for many it would be a corny, unwatchable mess. So 5 stars for me, 2 for most people, which leads me to my question for you. What are some movies that you would have to qualify your love for, recognizing that the idiosyncratic nature of your own taste makes it a top-notch experience, but that for most people it would be not great? Well, Freddy got fingered.
I mean, we've spent so long with the apple that I think we've kind of come at the other end of it and have decided that it's actually a work of genius.
Everyone loves the apple.
I mean, it's
if you see the apple, you love the apple.
You should, yes. It's hard to say. I mean, for example, like, you know, you and I loved that Japanese movie Happy Hour, but not everybody's necessarily going to be down for a 5-hour film about, you know, 4 middle-aged women and their friendship. But that's not so much of a formal barrier as it is just, you know, a length barrier for people. I don't know, the Mexican Santa Claus, perhaps?
Oh, sure. I mean, but again, if you watch it,
How can you not love it?
Yeah. Now, there are 2 other letters that we're going to save for next time because they are long and I want to give them the time and space that they deserve.
Okay.
One is about Titan and one is from Jesse Bylander with a list. And so we'll take care of those next time out.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for listening. You can subscribe to the show for free at Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, hey, leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the air. You can follow us on the social media at LinoleumCast. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Pick up his new album, 6 Tape, at blueBLEU.bandcamp.com. And once again, my new book, co-authored with the Deck the Hallmark podcast, I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, is now available wherever books are sold. Thanks for watching. You're not watching. Thanks for listening.
Listening, watching, loving,
however you're
learning,
doing it.
Singing.
Thanks for it. Anyway, have a good week.
We'll you know what else?
What?
We have a Patreon.
Oh, we do.
You go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. You look at the subscription levels. You subscribe at various levels of subscription. You get various levels of extra content.
Yes, you do.
Different podcasts for pretty much every level. So go.
Make it happen. Fun stuff. All right. Until next time.
Goodbye.